And so their whole approach was so different from what it is in so many other questions. And if you want to see this come through it in another way too, there's a book that was just published recently called The Turning Point. It's by Patty Crowley, a lay woman from Chicago who was, she and her husband Pat and Patty Crowley were the president couples of the Catholic Family Movement back in the 60s and the 70s when that movement was very, very big in this country. They were invited to be part of the birth control commission that John the 23rd had first set up, then Paul the 6th really brought to its completion. And this book tells the whole story of what happened and how that commission came to the point where, with the exception of four people, they voted unanimously to have the church take a different approach to birth control. And when you read the book, it's not a very large book, so it's easy to read and you go through it quickly. It's so interesting, though. You discover very quickly what changed the thinking of the commission was when they brought in married couples. And for the first time, these moral theologians had to deal with the real life experience of married people. Now, it seems absurd, I know, that we would be issuing statements and teachings that are supposed to guide everybody's life and yet never draw from the first-hand experience of those who are most involved. And yet that's what had been going on. And it's fascinating to watch the ones on that commission, and some moral theologians and world-renowned, how they changed their thinking when they began to draw from the life experience of people. And that's what has to happen with this whole issue, too. And you see, all the moral theology I learned in the seminary was written by people who were probably very homophobic because they had gone through seminary training like I had gone through. And so, you know, we had a very narrow understanding of this whole thing. And so the teaching that we have doesn't reflect the real life experience of people who are gay, who are lesbian. And as the church begins to draw that experience into herself, reflect on it, and then teach, we'll be much more in touch with the real situation of people in the church, and we'll be able to teach in a way that is much more adequate for gay and lesbian people. And so what we need to do is, I guess put it this way, the more people that come out, in a sense, the better off the church is going to be, both in the gay and lesbian community, but also family members like ourselves. You know, if we're willing to be public about this, then it's going to help other people, because it's out there in other families too. I'm sure I'm not the only bishop in the conference that has a gay sibling. I'm sure. No, I'm sure also that there are bishops in the conference who are gay. There's no question about it. Probably not many who have ever really allowed themselves to realize that. It's latent. But because, you know, we were taught in the seminary to repress it. If you did have any inclinations that way, you would be taught to repress it. And so I'm sure there are bishops who have repressed it their whole lives, and they wouldn't even want to think about the possibility. But others, I'm sure, know it. And but no one's willing to say it. And I wish also that, you know, bishops would be willing to let priests who are functioning in dioceses say, "I'm a gay priest." Right. See, why not? I mean, they're functioning very effectively as ministers. Some of them are the best ones we have. And let them say it. But I don't know any in the country. Bob may know some that are openly gay and still functioning, but so far we haven't allowed that to happen. But once we did, it could bring about a change very quickly. So I guess what I'm saying here is we have to encourage from our own experience, encourage other people to be much more open and ready to share their experience and be welcoming to their gay siblings or sons and daughters and so on. Yes.
Bishop Bumbleton, I believe there was a lady named Olga who was very instrumental in your accepting
yes.
the situation of your brother. Would you tell us that story?
Oh, okay. I know this woman personally, and it was very helpful to me. You're right. See, this is one of the things that I was going to put in my presentation, but then I didn't, so it's okay. Because different people along the way help you to change. And Olga is a woman who's in her middle 70s now. I met her because I'm on the board of a place called Francis House in Tampa, Florida. And it's a center for persons with AIDS, and they do tremendous work there. It's just incredible to me what can happen when in this case it was one person, a Franciscan sister, who got this thing going, and it's unbelievable what she's been able to do over the last probably 7 or 8 years now that it's been going. And so she invited me to be on the board, and so I am, and I go there a couple of times a year usually, and participate in activities that they do. Well, in going there, I met Olga, who shared with me her story, and then later it's in an interview, and so I can give you some of her words, because she's a volunteer at Francis House. And she says, "I love my work at Francis House, but I must admit it can be very painful at times. When I see all these sick and dying people, I end up reliving the death of my own son, Raul." Olga is a Cuban, and her son's name was Raul. "It all seems such a waste, so many kind and wonderful young people dying because of this disease. That is when I ask God for strength, and God always comes through. I am very fortunate to have the two best sons in the world, one on earth and the other in heaven. It is for the one in heaven that I have become an activist for gay rights and AIDS education. I promised my Raul, who died from complications of AIDS in 1990, that as long as I live, I will fight AIDS with all my heart and work for the dignity of gay society." Then she shares what her own experience. "I never had any shame that Raul was a homosexual. He was a proud man, and I am a proud mother. Raul told me he was gay a year after his father died, when he was in college. Even though I already knew in my heart, I can remember how shocked I was at first. I wanted to die. But I looked at my son, and I knew God loved him every bit as much as I did. And so I took him in an embrace, and that embrace lasted as long as he lived. In time, I was able to have peace, serenity, and acceptance. It was God who showed me the way, which is why I know God approves of what I'm doing these days. I remember when Raul got sick. He came to visit me in March 1990. He played tennis every day and looked so healthy. It was after he returned home that he became very tired and knew something was wrong. In late April, the doctors told him he had AIDS. My sister Hilda and I went to New York to be with him. He had to go in the hospital, and he died there 2 months later on June 29th. He was 34 years old. Yes, it was a terrible time, but I have many good memories. In Raul's last week of life, it was Gay Pride Week. His organization had worked with the city to have the Empire State Building illuminated in lavender in honor of the movement. Although Raul was very weak, I got him in a wheelchair and took him to the 16th floor of the building, where he could look out the window and see the beautiful light of the building at night. He began crying, and so did I. Then he turned to me and said, 'Mother, I'm not crying out of sadness and suffering. I'm crying for happiness and joy. I have lived long enough to see something I have worked so hard to accomplish.' That was Raul, always finding the bright side of the darkest moments. So I gave him my best smile and said, 'Son, take part of that light. You deserve it. Today, I keep the spirit of Raul alive through the work I do.'" And having met her, and understanding from her how she was so quick to say, this is my son, I love him, God loves him. It really did help me a whole lot when I was dealing with my own situation and having to respond to my mother. This was a mother who knew her son was loved by God, as he is. And so she was a real strength for me. And I was just felt very blessed that I had met her. And again, you see, that's an example of how we can be a strength to one another when we share our stories with each other. So that Olga did that for me.
He had what feelings that he had for being thrust out of the limelight, sort of.
I had not spoken to my brother before I did talked about it, and but I just presumed since he had come out that he wouldn't mind, and and the presumption was correct. Later on, after the NCR had published the story about the New Way Ministry meeting, he wrote a letter to the NCR. It was a very beautiful letter, and very affirming of what I did, and talked about our family. It was very good. So he's very pleased with the way things have happened. Could bring to your attention a couple of things that I find helpful, and then we can take up other discussions or discussion any other questions you want. You know, last night I spoke about the need for the church as it tries to, draw out further understanding on this whole question, needs to draw from the experience of gay and lesbian people. And one of the things that made me very much aware of that was an article that perhaps you have heard about or read called I'm Here by Andrew Sullivan. It appeared in America Magazine in 1993 in May. And I found it a very, very useful article. And it's an interview with him. Andrew Sullivan is the editor of the New Republic, I think I mentioned that. Which is a national magazine, an opinion journal. And he's from England, grew up in a very staunchly Roman Catholic family. And he shares a lot of himself in this article. But just what he says about experience, I think, is very, very important. He says, I know that there are many things within homosexual life that can be wrong, just as in heterosexual life they can be wrong. There are many things in my sexual and emotional life that I do not believe are spiritually pure in any way. It's fraught with moral danger. But at its deepest level, it struck me as completely inconceivable from my own moral experience, from a real, honest attempt to understand that experience, that it was wrong. And now what he's talking about here is homosexual activity. He says, I experienced coming out in exactly the way you would think. I didn't really express any homosexual emotions or commitments or relationships until I was in my early 20s, partly because of the strict religious upbringing I had and my commitment to my faith. It was not something I blew off casually. I struggled enormously with it. But as soon as I actually explored the possibility of human contact within my emotional and sexual makeup, in other words, as soon as I allowed myself to love someone, all the constructs the church had taught me about the inherent disorder seemed just so self-evidently wrong that I could no longer find it that problematic. Because my own moral sense was overwhelming, because I felt through the experience of loving someone or being allowed to love someone, an enormous sense of the presence of God for the first time in my life. See, what he's saying is that he had gone through his life to that point without really experiencing God, because God is love. And where love is, there is God. And then as he allowed himself to love and be loved, he says, for the first time in my life, I really knew God. Now, I'm sure people could say, well, he's imagining all that and so on, but that's his experience. And we really, I don't think, can just arbitrarily deny someone's experience. So when he says, I discovered God in that human love, I'm ready to accept that as real, just as any one of us. When we love and are loved, we can experience God. And he also speaks of the sort of the opposite side of that. He said, the moral consequences in my own life of the refusal to allow myself to love another human being were disastrous. In other words, as long as he kept himself kind of walled off and refused to love or be loved, to enter into a deep, intimate human relationship, he said the consequences were disastrous. They made me permanently frustrated and anger and bitter. It spilled over into other areas of my life. Once that emotional blockage is removed, one's whole moral equilibrium can improve, just as a single person's moral equilibrium in a whole range of areas can improve with marriage. In many ways, because there is a kind of stability and security and rock upon which to build one's moral and emotional life. To deny this to gay people is not merely incoherent and wrong from a Christian point of view. It is incredibly destructive of the moral quality of their lives in general. And then he says, does this make sense to do this to anyone? These things are part of a continuous moral whole. You can't ask someone to suppress what makes them whole as a human being and then to lead blameless lives. We are human beings and we need love in our lives in order to love others, in order to be good Christians. What the church is asking gay people to do is not to be holy, but actually to be warped. And so he comes out very strongly that out of his experience, he feels that he became, is able to become a whole person because of being able to love and to be loved. Another thing that he brings out in that article, and probably I don't need to stress this much at all, is because you've experienced, is as he grew up, and his family too, there was no place in the church that he could find ministry. And he, you know, the church was reaching out to minister to him and to his family. And he tells in this article of a very poignant experience that he had when he went to, he attends Mass regularly at St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington, D.C., that's where he lives. And the day that the quilt, AIDS quilt, was in Washington, he had spent a lot of time there that day and heard the names of all his, so many of his friends who had died and the names of many others. And he went to the cathedral that evening for a Mass, and it happened that the gospel that Sunday was about the lepers, people who are alienated and marginalized. And he just felt so strongly it would have been a marvelous opportunity, because this was a public event, that the AIDS quilt was there, that the priest might speak about others marginalized and victims of AIDS who are shoved aside. And he heard nothing, and he just felt so left out of that whole experience. And he spoke to the priest afterwards and said, couldn't you have said something? And the priest just was unaware, totally unaware of his need or his experience and the lack of any reaching out to him. And that's been his experience so often in his life. That's one of the reasons why what you're doing here, I think, is so important. Once more, I say that. That you're beginning to minister to one another, you're beginning to develop ministry within the church. You'll be pushing the bishops in your dioceses to do more ministry, priests that you know. And so it's going to grow and develop because of people like yourselves. One other thing that I thought might be helpful too is to show that, and maybe some of you are aware of this, that there is beginning to be a change in the thinking or in the way that people react within the church, ministers, and And I find this helpful. For example, Archbishop Weakland of Milwaukee, in a column he wrote for his diocesan newspaper back some time ago about gay and lesbian people, he says, "First, I would like to state I do not have all the answers in this highly complex issue, but it seems to me we should begin by approaching it with a sense of calm and prayerful searching, remembering the compassion Jesus had for people who were struggling to find the kingdom. He saw through the labels that society pinned on Gentiles, tax collectors, and prostitutes, and recognized beneath these name tags persons worth caring about, simply because they too were sons and daughters of God." And that's really, I suppose, the first thing we have to do, and what I hope the church would help us to do, is to see people, real people. And of course, you do with your sons and daughters. And then he speaks about, well, there's a lot, but what is helpful. "It seems clear to me that gay people, like all of us, fare better when they are able to develop stable relationships, when they are not relegated to a same-sex society, when they are permitted to contribute their talents to relieving injustices in our society, when they are loved and respected as people striving to grow humanly and spiritually. And so I invite all in the Catholic community to join me in showing this kind of respect as we try to work out the rightful place of these people in church life. I ask for calm, careful study, prayer, and reflection so that we can assist all members of society in the exercise of their rights, so that no one is treated as a second-class citizen or as somehow, quotes, contaminated." And I think that's a very sound, solid approach. What it also does is it says to us, we're learning. The church hasn't said the last word on any of this. And it's very, very clear to me that we have a lot to learn and we have a lot to continue to try to articulate. And another piece, and I think maybe Bob has distributed this, is some things that Cardinal Hume said in London. "Love between two persons, whether of the same sex or of a different sex, is to be treasured and respected. To love another, whether of the same sex or of a different sex, is to have entered the area of richest human experience." Nothing in the Church's teaching can be said to support or sanction, even implicitly, the victimization of homosexual men and women. Furthermore, homophobia should have no place among Catholics. But I think that's beautiful that he would say so clearly that love between two persons, whether of the same sex or of a different sex, is to be treasured and respected. Now, I also bring to your attention, and you may know about this, this is a book now that Andrew Sullivan has just recently published. It came out at the end of August this year. It's called Virtually Normal, and it's subtitled An Argument About Homosexuality. And I find it very, very clear, and he writes in a very clear it's very disciplined writing, and it's very easy to read, although it's very profound in a lot of ways. And in this, he speaks again about his own experience, and this is something that I think is so important, because it's denied by some, and especially some within the church, and that is that his experience of discovering who he is as a gay person, and that it wasn't something he chose at some point. As he grew up, he became gradually aware of who he was and is. And again, I think that's very valid when someone can say this, and this is more and more my experience of gay and lesbian people, that they never chose it, it wasn't imposed upon them, it isn't a disorder that somehow they picked up. It's something that, it's the way they are, it's who they are. And this is so key, I think, that it isn't a learned way of acting. It's a way of acting that flows from within themselves at the deepest level of who they are as a human person. And in here, even in the very first chapter, he examines quite carefully some of the scriptural texts that people use to say you can't do it, you know, that it's absolutely wrong. And it isn't a lengthy exposition of this, but it's very concise, very clear, and I find very helpful. And it's based on solid scriptural research. And so that, he also shows clearly the inadequate response that sometimes people would say, well, that why homosexual acts are wrong, that, well, it's like being an alcoholic. You hate the sin, but you love the sinner. And he just shows that this is very, homosexuality is very different from that because it's who you are as a person. It goes right to the depths of your being. And the other people use the analogy of a cripple or other people, a sterile person and so on. And he just quickly takes apart these arguments and shows you a different response. And so I find it very helpful. He, at the end of the book, the second last chapter, he has a chapter on a politics of homosexuality, how to deal with this in the public arena, in a sense. And the final thing is an epilogue on what are homosexuals for? You know, and he explores, you know, the hard question, why did God make some people homosexual? If the other is the perfect way to be, well, why did God do this? You know, did God make a mistake? You know that? And so he explores some reasons why this is a very important part of the whole of creation, and should be cherished. You know, the whole idea of homosexuality, but homosexual persons should be cherished as an important part of God's creation. And if we could ever get to that point, of course, that it would be marvelous, where we would see homosexual people not as aberrations, not as disordered people or anything of the sort, but as another expression of the just unlimited creative power of God, putting variety and difference into creation in so many beautiful ways, and that this is one more aspect of the total beauty of God's creation. And so I found that a very helpful chapter to read, and I'm sure many of you would, and I think a lot of homosexual people would. So those are just a few opening comments, and now if you want, we could go back to a lot of discussion and I don't know, maybe Bob or Marina are going to enter into
it. Time for questions and comments, whatever you want.
Yeah, okay. Way in the back.
I just wanted to say, I saw him interviewed on C-SPAN a few weeks ago about this book, and he was very impressive, Andy Sullivan. And one thing that he said was that he, just putting everything very clearly, as you say, he said as he grew up as a teenager, he experienced exactly the same emotions and things on the change of life and puberty and all going through puberty as anybody else would. His experience is exactly the same. It was simply directed towards men rather than towards women.
Yeah.
I thought that was such a clear, concise way of putting it. And he also said when he came out to his parents being English, he thought this was very amusing, that his mother's first response was, I must go make a cup of tea.
that's very good. Okay, well, that's fine. I'm glad you found them helpful. I think any of you will if you want to take the time to. Yes?
I